It's time for Football Asia with Paul Williams.
Yes, our weekly chat with Paul Williams from the Asian Game Podcast. Evening to you, Paul. How are you, mate?
How are you, Paul?
Simon, I think I've got you now.
There we go.
There he is.
we thought you'd nodded off.
It had gone silent for the last minute. I'm like, oh, what's going on? I hope they come through. I've got you. How you going,
okay,
guys?
We're good. We're good. And we're very, very relieved to have you with us. Let's kick off with the AFC Cup final, which takes place on Saturday in Bahrain. It's the local club Muharraq against Nassaf of Uzbekistan. And get used to these names, people in Australia, because our only clubs are going to be playing in this competition. You did a great interview with Syed Mohammed Jaffer, the veteran keeper of Muharraq, on your podcast this week. Mm. Are they going to be the strong favourites because they're at home?
You would think so. And I was speaking to someone in Bahrain because I wasn't sure. I even said so in the interview with Syed when I spoke to him, what the current level of restrictions in Bahrain is and what crowd they're allowing in. But I spoke with someone who works at the FA in Bahrain. They're allowing a full house in, which is fantastic news. And the Muharraq fans make a great atmosphere. So you'd imagine because of that, playing at home, having the crowd behind them, they'll go in as favourites, you would imagine, against Nassaf. And it's a competition that has been dominated by clubs from the Gulf and the Middle East in particular. I think only twice since 2004 when the competition was formed have teams not from that part of the world won the competition. One was FC Nassaf themselves in 2011, the other 2015 when JDT from Malaysia won. So they're two evenly matched teams. And of course, we mentioned last week, Kaludrovic, the former Brisbane Roar and Wellington striker, plays for FC Nassaf. And so there's a little bit of A-League interest in this final. But I'd imagine Muharraq would be favourites going in. You could tell in the interview that I did with Syed, he was very relaxed, very calm when I spoke to him just a couple of days before the final. I imagine that bodes well for them.
The national team competition in that particular region, the Arab Cup, is about to start at the end of the month. It's the first time the tournament has had the FIFA branding. Well, we'll probably ask you about the teams involved a little bit closer to the time, but with this FIFA branding, it's going to be staged in Qatar. I presume it's another test event for the World Cup, but should we read anything into the fact that FIFA have taken over the branding and as to the reason why?
I don't think we should. And I think it's important to create the distinction that the Arab Cup is different to the Gulf Cup.
Yep.
So the Gulf Cup is the big tournament in that region that gets held every 2 years, I think it is. The Arab Cup is separate to that. It's got its own history. It was first held back in the 1960s and held sort of sporadically ever since. But it doesn't just contain teams from the Asian side of the continent as well. It mixes all teams from the Arab part of the world. So it includes teams from Asia and Africa as well. So it bodes to be a really, really interesting competition. If you've got teams like, you know, Morocco, Egypt, Algeria coming up against the likes of, you know, Qatar, Iraq, Lebanon, Bahrain as well, it could throw up some really, really interesting matchups. So I'm fascinated to see how this tournament goes. I hope we get to see some of it here in Australia. As you said, it is a warm-up for the World Cup. It replaces the Confederations Cup that's normally held 12 months out. So this is the official FIFA test event for the World Cup 12 months out, which is a little scary to think we're only 12 months from another World Cup.
It is. Mate, what about the Women's Asian Cup draw that's been released? We spoke last week about Alan Stajic taking over the Philippines women's team, and it was always going
to
happen.
Had to be,
always going to happen, wasn't it? So the Malditas will be playing the Matildas, and Thailand and Indonesia also in the group. Tell us about that.
I wish I had a dollar for every time someone mentions the Malditas versus the Matildas over the next couple of months. I could probably retire on that, I reckon. And what's great about that is it's a 3:30 kickoff local time, which is about, if my calculations are correct, a 9 p.m. kickoff on the east coast of Australia. So it's going to be in prime time, which is absolutely fantastic. The Matildas got a pretty good draw from the group stage. But as I said last week as well, the crossover group then makes it really interesting because they'll play the runner-up in Group C, which has Japan and Korea. So you'd probably think that's going to be Korea, then they potentially have to face China in a semi-final and Japan in a final. So
you've got it all worked out, Paul.
It's all worked out. It's already done. It's just a matter of running the event now. But people are talking about the dream draw from the Matildas. We shouldn't get sucked into that too much because while the group stage on paper looks, you know, relatively easy, it's the knockout stage where it becomes more difficult, and they're drawn probably on the tougher side of the draw. But there is some fantastic stories in this tournament as well. Iran qualified for the first time in their history, which is a beautiful story given that if you go back only a decade, they were effectively banned from football because of the headscarf rule that Australia's Mojaddad, amongst others, fought so hard to get overturned. And now they've qualified for their first tournament. They beat Jordan, who hosted the last tournament, to make it. Indonesia ended a 33-year drought. So you've got sort of two giants, you know, population-wise and in football sense, in Indonesia and Iran, that have never really achieved anything in women's football. And they've qualified for this tournament, which I guess goes to show a great sign of progress that's being made. And the other interesting tidbit is the number one ranked team in Asia at the moment is actually North Korea, believe it or not. It's not Japan or Australia. But they withdrew from the tournament for COVID reasons, as they have with every international tournament. So Asia's number one ranked team won't actually be at the Asian Cup.
Wow, interesting. Let's move over to the club side of things in Asia. There were some midweek games in the J-League overnight. Mm. Kevin Muscat's Yokohama F Marinos missed a big chance to all but secure second spot. They went down 1-0 at home to Gamba, all of which means that Kawasaki Frontale are back-to-back champions after their draw against Urawa.
Indeed. And it was nervy times for them. They conceded late against Urawa. Drew 1-1, and then they had to wait a minute or two before they found out the result from the other game, and it was confirmed. And, another loss for Yokohama. They're not in particularly great form at the moment as they come towards the end of the season. They'll easily finish second. It's just a matter of time before they officially seal that. But as I said last week, Muskie's got some work to do. But I think we just have to give full credit to Kawasaki. Back-to-back, it's now four titles in 5 years. So this is an absolute dynasty. Of course, the one they didn't win was when Ange took Yokohama all the way to clinch that title. But they are just a formidable outfit. Toru Aniki probably doesn't get the credit he deserves. I don't know what he has to do to get spoken about in higher terms, but, you know, they continue to produce players. Rio Hatate, Mitoma, who's now
could
gone
be
over
going to
Europe
Celtic
as well.
Hatate.
Yeah, well, that's the rumour going around as well, that the Ange is eyeing him off along with Daisen Maeda from his former club as well. So full credit to Kawasaki. They're a formidable team. The only thing missing now for them is the Champions League. They've always bombed out in the Champions League and not done too well. Next year, surely their opportunity. They've done everything they can in the J-League. They've got to go all out to win that next year.
Hey, I'm sure they will. Paul, we spoke during the week about my old club, Shimizu S-Pulse. They're only 2 points off relegation with a couple of games to go. They've got a hard draw coming up. How do you think they'll go?
It's going to be tough. They actually sacked their coach this afternoon as well. So they understand the predicament that they're in. They actually dropped a position. So they're literally just sitting above the relegation zone now, because I think it was Shonan Balmare got a draw which shot them above Shimizu on goal difference. So they're in a precarious position. I think they've obviously, given where they are on the ladder, all the teams they play above them now are above them on the table. They've got Urawa coming up, which will be really difficult. The only thing that might save them is that the teams below them aren't very good either, and the odds of them picking up points is relatively slim. They've got a 2-point gap, which may just be enough to save them, but all it takes is a win or two for the teams below them, and they could be in a spot of bother.
Paul, we're going to have to leave it there, mates, but thank you so much again for your time. We'll speak to you in a couple of weeks.
See you, Paul.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.
That is Paul Williams. And incidentally, Alex Grant, hero to zero, scored that late equaliser in the Champions League. Then 4 days later, he scored the own goal that condemned Pohang to defeat at home to Incheon. The different emotions of football. We're off to a quick break, and then we'll wrap up the show with Robbie Middleby on our Greatest Games segment.